should note that, for sure. Does indicate in one other place that he believes that this claim that one killed under internal compulsion has legal results, because he uses this to defend Moshe Rabbeinu for killing the Egyptian in outrage at the injustice committed by the Egyptian, even though it seems clear from Bechor Shor that the Egyptian did not deserve death. And we'll perhaps return to that at the end of the shir. Okay, we're now moving on to source number 7. We're now going to quote a series of cases and see if they provide genuine Talmudic evidence for the legitimacy of such a plea. So the first case, which is source number 7 in your packet, Shabbat Daf Kuf Nun Gimel Lamed Aleph, Shabbat 153a, says the following: Misha Hechshich Baderech, somebody who was traveling at sunset on Friday, meaning that they're traveling when Shabbat hits and they haven't reached their destination, and in particular they're carrying their money on Shabbat, and so what they can do is notain kisol nochri. So if a Jew traveling at sunset on Shabbat on Friday evening should or is entitled to give his purse to a non-Jew to carry, but if he has no non-Jew with him, manichol achamor, then he can put it on his own donkey. Okay, even though each of these are usually violations, in particular, giving the purse to the non-Jew to carry for you to your destination is a violation of the general principle of Amira l'Nachri, that you are not allowed to ask a non-Jew to perform actions for you on Shabbat that you, the Jew, would not be allowed to perform yourself. So the Gemara asks, "My tama shorule rabbanon lemesav kisele nachri." So what is the reason that the rabbis gave him permission, in this case, to give his purse to the non-Jew and thereby ask the non-Jew to do something that he would himself be permitted to doing? So kimlehu lerabbanon, right? The rabbis affirmed, meaning the rabbis took as a legal principle of fact, de'ein adam amidat small mamono, that a person does not restrain themselves with regard to their money. Ilo sharitle, so if you would not permit him, ati lisuya dalad amas pershus rabim, then the person would himself come to violate the biblical prohibition against carrying an object 4 cubits in a public domain. So here it seems at first hand that we have a confirmation of Bechor Shor's position, because here, as a result of the claim in Adam Amidat Smol Mamono, we have a direct legal consequence, right? There's no indirect consequence, there's a result leading to some other phenomenon because of unclean hands or anything like that. Here, because in Adam Amidat Smol Mamono, because people do not restrain themselves with regard to their money, therefore we permit something which would otherwise be prohibited, namely handing the purse to a non-Jew. So there are two things. First of all, here, one should note again that Bechor Shor said, "Ein adam yachol hamida asmal mamono." Bechor Shor said people are incapable of doing so, whereas the Talmud simply says that people do not. Right? Talmud may be describing what most people will do without saying that people could not exercise will and act better. And that's particularly significant here, because what's going on here is not actually, we're not actually letting the person get away with something forbidden. Right? It's not that we're not holding the person legally accountable for handing the purse to the non-Jew. What's really happening here is that the reason the rabbis forbade asking a non-Jew to do something that you could yourself not do is because we're afraid that asking a non-Jew will end up leading you to do it yourself. Right? This is a protective rabbinic legislation. But in this particular case, the legislation would be counterproductive, because it actually would lead to more people violating the biblical prohibition, because people would say, if there's no permitted way of getting my wallet home, then I might as well carry it myself, which will make me more secure. So this is a case in which the rabbis chose not to legislate. So the act actually becomes entirely permitted It's not that we're absolving you of responsibility for violating the rabbinic prohibition, it's that the act becomes permitted. And for the rabbis to choose this, they don't have to believe that it was impossible for you to restrain yourself. They don't have to believe that no one would have or could have simply left their purse where it was and gone on. They simply have to believe that most people, or a significant number of people, wouldn't do so, because people don't always do the right thing even if they can. And therefore, they thought that the way in which they could minimize the number of biblical violations would be to allow this action entirely legally, not to absolve somebody, but to allow it. So I don't think you can demonstrate here that the Horshor is correct, that that we say that people are incapable of restraining themselves with regard to their money, and that therefore we absolve them of liability for their acts. Okay, let's move on to source number 8. Source number 8 is from a work called the Kovetz Ha'arot on Masechet Yevamot, which is written by Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. It says the following. V'ramam sham od zelashon. The Ramam there says further, Mi shechashka nafsho b'Torah tamid. Somebody whose soul adores Torah continually. V'shogeba kiven azai. And he steeps himself in it, like Rabbi Shimon ben Azai. V'davak ba kol yamav. And he cleaves to it all his days. V'lo nasa isha. And therefore, he never marries. Ein v'yado avon. Right? He has not sinned. Even though the Ramam says earlier that anybody who reaches the age, any male who reaches the age of 20 unmarried has committed a grievous violation. So why here does he have no sin? So the context of this is that in general, right, we believe that when we have a conflict between learning Torah and other mitzvot, so learning Torah takes priority unless the other mitzvah is one whose time will pass. And Rabbi Elchanan had previously explained this as meaning that you're allowed to delay other mitzvot for the purpose of Torah, but you're not allowed to put them off. You're not allowed to be mevatel them. You're not allowed to entirely annul them. So, Rabbi Elchanan says, in this case, we're saying if you die without getting married, so you haven't just put the mitzvah off, you have in fact been mevatel the mitzvah. So why do we say that you have not sinned? So there are other explanations, but I'm interested particularly in Rabbi Elchanan's explanation. He's, as of now, he says, the venira de be'emes ki haigavna eino patur mitzvah piravirivya. So it seems to him, he says, that even in a case like Ben Azai, where you adore Torah continually, you're not exempt from the mitzvah of procreation. Ela dechashiv ka'anus bevitula. But you're considered to be compelled in your nullification of that commandment. Ukulashon HaRambam, right, and he says if you read the Rambam carefully, the Rambam's language implies this. So the Rambam says, Ein biyado avon, he has no sin in his hand. The Rambam doesn't say that he's acted properly. Right? The Rambam says he has no sin in his hand, which Rav Elchanan reads, I think, with good justification as saying that you're not held responsible for an act that is objectively sin. V'hainu de Ben Azai, right, meaning, as in the case of Ben Azai, haya davuk kol kach b'Torah, who was so attached to Torah, shelo haya yachol hasiach dato imenu l'davar acher, that he was incapable, in fact, of removing his mind to actually engage in a human relationship. Right? The Talmud elsewhere suggests that Ben Azai, in fact, had been married, but was incapable of sustaining the marriage. Right? So Rav Elchanan says it's not that such a person is exempt from procreation, it's simply that we can't hold them responsible for not procreating, because in order to procreate, you have to marry. And in order to marry, you have to form a genuine relationship. And Ben Azai's relationship with Torah was so strong that he could not form another relationship. Okay, so it seems that Rav Elchanan Wasserman here is willing to accept the claim of internal compulsion for Torah. Right here again, it's the passion for the law overriding one's physical desire for sex to such a point that we can't hold you accountable for failing to engage in sexual relations, which I think is an interesting, ironic twist on the classic Western case. And Rav Elchanan seems to take this as a compelling legal plea. So the question is, does that go far enough to prove Bechor Shor's contention that there is such a plea in criminal cases? So there are a number of ways in which it is insufficient. One is that we're dealing here with failure to fulfill a positive commandment. And a plea that is acceptable for failure to fulfill a positive commandment may not be sufficient to avoid liability for actually violating a negative commandment. But I think the second and more compelling case is that there are alternative explanations of the Rambam, particularly saying that there is no specific time, despite the Rambam's claim that if you haven't fulfilled it ordinarily by 20, that you have sinned grievously. But in fact, it's not a mitzvah whose time passes. All one's life, one is obligated to fulfill and one is capable of fulfilling the obligation to procreate. And all Benazir did was he kept pushing it off and pushing it off, and then he happened to die before he fulfilled it. So long as Benazir never explicitly decided that he would never fulfill it, it might be that the mitzvah of Torah is sufficient to enable him to push off this commandment. Okay. So Rav Elchanan, which means we now have an Acharon to go along with the Bechor Shor the Rishon, seems to believe that there is such a plea, not clear that he extends it to criminal cases, not clear that his evidence is compelling. Okay, that brings us to source number 9, which appears in the Talmud, both in Tractate Zvachim 102b, Kuf Bet Amid Bet, and in Kedushin, Lamed Gimel Amid Aleph 33a. Amar Rava, Rava said, Hai Dina, Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Shimon, Gemirna, Amar Rave Sakisei, etc. Rava quotes Halacha, he says, I learned this Halacha from Rabbi Lazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon, in the bathroom. So the Talmud asks, in the bathroom? But Rava Bar Brachana said, Nein Rabbi Yochanan, B'chol makom utar lahar herechuz v'merchatz v'et ha-kisei. Right, you're entitled to think about Torah everywhere except in the bathhouse and in the bathroom. So how could Rabbi Ezra, Rabbi Shimon say this halacha to Rava? So the Gemara answers la'on so shani, that when under compulsion is different. And what it seems to mean here is that some people are so compelled to think about Torah that they're simply not capable of not thinking about Torah in the bathroom. There are all sorts of interesting stories about contemporary rabbis having shower radios so that they could avoid thinking about Torah in the shower by playing radios the entire time. So here again it seems that we have an action which would otherwise be forbidden, thinking about Torah in the bathroom, which we treat somebody as absolved of responsibility for because they're under compulsion. They're so absorbed in Torah. So perhaps this should be treated as sufficient evidence for Bechor Shor. So I think again here that it's not quite enough for a number of reasons. One is that it's very likely that the prohibition against learning Torah in the bathroom is only rabbinic. So this might be evidence that you're absolved of responsibility for violating rabbinic prohibitions under internal compulsion, but that you could not use such a plea in biblical cases. And a second question is whether allowing yourself to be overwhelmed by a generally positive passion, such as that for Torah, is something that we account for, which is not the same as saying that we would allow you to give in to a negative passion, such as bloodlust. Furthermore, it's possible that since this is only a rabbinic case, that we could argue that the rabbis wish to encourage people to be utterly absorbed in Torah, and if they were to hold people accountable for learning in bathrooms, then people would have great hesitancy about really total dedication to Torah, because they would know that that would inevitably bring them into violation. And therefore, this might be, as in source number 7, a case where the rabbis chose not to make their decree, and they declare that somebody who's so absorbed in Torah that they have no choice but to think about it all the time is not subject to the prohibition against learning in the bathroom. Again, this is predicated on the claim that that prohibition is rabbinic. I'm not sure there's any good evidence one way or the other on that question. So the evidence begins to add up for Bechor Shor. All right, that brings us to source number 10. Source number 10 is Gemara in Shavuot, Daf Chav Vav Amud Aleph, Shavuot 26a. Amar Mar, so we begin with by re-quoting a statement. Ha'adam Bishvua, which is a quote from the Torah. Prat La'anus, so a person is accountable for violating their oath unless they made the oath under compulsion. So Talmud wants to know, what's the case of a violation, unless they violated the oath under compulsion? Perhaps, or made the oath under compulsion. We'll see how you interpret it. So what's the case of an oath under compulsion? So the Talmud says that the case is like Rav Kahana and Rav Asi. In what sense is it like the case? What's the case of Rav Kahana and Rav Asi? Because Kiavu Kaimi Mekami de Rav, when they were standing before Rav, it's not clear whether this happened once or whether this would happen continually. One of them, but I think it only happened once. One of them said, "I swear that Rav said the following." One of them said, "No. I swear that Rav said the other thing, the opposite." So when they came later back to Rav, Amar kechad minayu. He said, "You know, one of you was right and one of you was wrong." So Amar le'idach. So the other one said, "Vana b'shikra ishtavai." Does that mean that I swore falsely about what Rav said, that I'm liable for having made a false oath? So Rav said to this worried student, Libcha anascha, your heart compelled you. So here, we seem to have a clear case where somebody violated an oath, and we hold them not liable for violating their oath, because they were under internal compulsion, their heart compelled them. So that would seem to be a pretty good case for Horshor, although the problem is that this is actually a very difficult case to understand. Why? Since the person at the time they made the oath, right, did not intend to swear falsely, right, clearly they believed what they were saying is true, so this should be treated as a case of Shvua B'Shogeg, of a mistaken oath, as opposed to a false oath, and it's not at all clear why that's not the case. Furthermore, one can argue that the point here is not that someone is unliable for having sworn a false oath. The point here is that taking an oath requires a certain amount of capacity to exercise judgment, and if somebody takes an oath under overwhelming emotional stress, so we view that as anybody looking at him would say, that person isn't really intending to commit themselves in that way, and therefore it's not genuinely an oath. It's not that we hold you not liable for having made a false oath, it's that we invalidate the oath as such. But these are explanations. It seems to me that the simplest reading of this case would support Bechor Shor's claim that there are cases in which internal compulsion is a legitimate plea. Although we note again here that that one can view this as being overcome by a positive as opposed to a negative passion. That this is all part of their dedication to Torah. Although, one could also see this as being involved in ego issues, which would be a negative reading. It seems to me, though, that the more likely reading of the story is that we treat them as being overwhelmed by their passion for truth. So that wouldn't quite tell us something about somebody committing a murder out of lust or something like that. Although, again, it's a very vague distinction, because one might argue that in the classic case, that one kills one's spouse out of a passion for social morality or out of human love as opposed to lust, could be. Okay, one more case. This is a Gemara, case number, source number 11, the Gemara in Ksuvot, Daf Nun Aleph Amud Bet, 51b. The Gemara in Ksuvot says the following. In the midst of a longer discussion, we're only interested in this narrow line for now. Rava said, "Kol shetchilata be'ones v'sof b'rason muteret." So the general rule is that if a wife commits adultery willingly, that she and her husband are then required to divorce. They're no longer allowed to be intimate. So Rava says, "What about a case which begins as rape? In which case, there would be no prohibition." But it ends consensually. We don't know, although the simplest reading is that this is a specific act. And I'd rather not get into the issues of whether such a case is realistic or not. We can treat it simply as an abstract discussion. If it talking about an ongoing circumstance as opposed to a particular act, so then this would be what is known in modern terms as Stockholm syndrome, where somebody falls in love with the captor. But Rava says, in principle, if you have a case which begins, I think it makes much more sense as a specific act, which begins as onus, as rape, and ends piratzon, and ends willing, muteret, then the wife is nonetheless, even though the end of the sexual act was willing, the wife is permitted to remain intimate with her husband. My Tama, why should this be? Because yetzer alavsha, because desire overwhelmed her. So here it seems that, you know, ordinarily the act of adultery carries a specific consequence. Let's assume that there aren't witnesses, so we're not, or at least there aren't witnesses in such a way that we could in fact exercise capital jurisdiction and execute the woman for adultery. But there's a lesser consequence for adultery, which is the prohibition to the husband. And Rava says that in this case, we don't hold someone accountable for that act, because desire overwhelmed her. And that would seem to be really a very strong piece of evidence for Bechor Shor's position. The only distinction one can really make at this point, well, I guess one could make two distinctions. One distinction is that it's very possible that the wife in question here has no physical choice, right? The sexual act will happen regardless of her choices, right? Meaning that the rapist will not cease the act of rape because she's unwilling, as evidence that he began it. However, right, the only thing that she can control is her attitude. And we don't hold people legally liable for a change, right, for a change in intent under duress, as opposed to a change in action. And furthermore, she's not being overwhelmed here by emotion, but we're dealing with a hormonal release. Right, and saying that people's, when their bodies are in the control of others, so their bodies may be manipulated in such a way that chemically they're incapable of controlling themselves, is not the same as allowing a plea of internal compulsion. Finally, it may be that, in fact, Rava would not have allowed this plea in the criminal case, but the rules as to whether or not a woman is permitted to her husband after such a case are not the same as criminal liability. The standard is different, and there are other ways in which that standard is different, because the standard of prohibition is defined by the verb me'ila, to a breach in the relationship. And it might be that this is not considered a breach in the relationship, even if we would view it as a criminal act of adultery. So again, I think that there are a lot of cases here. We're starting to get to the point where there's a lot of smoke, and we can suspect there's a fire, although we haven't quite conclusively proven Bechor Shor's case yet. That brings us to source number 12. Source number 12 is the Gemara in Mako, Staf Yudam Bet, Tractate Mako 10b.
Amar Rav Huna, Rotzeach Shegalal Leir Miklat, Mitzao Goel Hadam, Rashi says, B'derech Halichato, V'harago Patur. So Rav Huna says that if the blood avenger, that is to say, the closest relative of somebody who burnt halacha, is entitled to pursue the accidental homicide, the accidental killer, and to kill the killer, so long as they have not reached the cities of refuge, where they're invulnerable from such retaliation. This says that what happens if the murderer is on the way to the city of refuge. Right? We know that if the murderer has been convicted and therefore sentenced to stay in the city of refuge, then if he leaves the city of refuge, then he's fair game. But what happens if he's on his way to the city of refuge? So Rav Huna says the blood avenger finds and kills him, and he's exempt from punishment. Interesting language. What does it mean? Right? Why is he exempt from punishment? Not that he's done the right thing. Exempt from punishment. So on this, the Amek Davar, the Netziv, in his commentary Dvarim 19.6, points out that in the case of the blood avenger of the accidental homicide, the Torah says that the reason that the murderer is not executed, the killer is not executed, is Kilo Sanelo Mitzmol Shalshom. A does not did not hate B previously. So who is A and who is B? So the Nativ says it seems to him that the commentary of the Ritva is correct, that we're dealing that the right that the case here is that we do not execute the blood avenger because he's not acting out of hate, because he didn't hate the murderer previously. Ella, right, this is right, the language of the verse is Radaku Ella Damasarav Ki Talmudabo. The blood avenger chases after him because his heart is inflamed. It's heated. So the Nativ says that the blood avenger is not did not originally hate the accidental homicide. Elavavocham, but rather his heart is heated up. And this brings him to that. Right, so the Nativ seems pretty clearly to believe that in this case the blood avenger is exempt from punishment, not because the accidental he killed somebody who deserves killing, but because he is acting out of emotion. And that emotion, right, the sudden emotion at seeing a close relative killed is sufficient to exempt him from criminal liability. And then, to make the case stronger, he says, Reze kimosha libo onso. And this is as if his heart has compelled him. So the Tziv sees this case as an illustration of the same principle that we saw in source number 10. Which means that he read source number 10 also as supporting this notion that when your heart inflames, you can be exempt from criminal punishment. And furthermore, he goes on to say, and he says the same principle can be found in source number 11. So Nitziv thinks that sources 10, 11, and 12 all form a pattern, and that pattern is a claim that one can, in fact, make a claim of internal compulsion. One can make the crime of passion defense in halachic criminal law. Okay. And the Tziv, basically, by that is contending, since there is no other, either that we know this misvara, this is rational, or else that one can take the case of Goel Hadam, right, the case in Makot, the case of the blood avenger, as a paradigm. So now we have two, we have one Rishon, who explicitly believes in such a plea. His paradigm is the case of the furtive trespasser, and one Achram, the Nitziv, whose paradigm is the case of the blood avenger. But now we have to say, okay, we have one Rishon, one Achram. Right? Each of these cases can be read in other ways. Are they right? Are their cases paradigms? So here I think one can make a compelling Shalmei Sanhedrin 8:8, in which we have once again Rav Huna, the same Rav Huna of source number 12, that says the following: Natalakis, if the furtive trespasser has already taken the money of the householder, v'hafachet panav latzeit, and now he's on his way out. So at this point, the householder is not defending his money; he's trying to get his money back. And at that point, right, and this, it would seem, is no longer the case of the Torah. The Torah says that in lo dechayim, a furtive trespasser does not cause blood guilt for killing him, but that's presumably in defense of money. What about if you're trying to get your money back? Right, where you clearly are initiating the confrontation, at this point the thief isn't doing anything more wrong. Okay, interesting distinction that it should be different. Rav Huna says that if the householder, right, even let's suppose the halachlo, let's suppose the thief is already gone, right, and now you find the thief in the street months later. Maybe Rav Huna is that extreme, we don't know. The amadala b'harago, and now the householder stands against him and kills him. That the householder is trying to get his money back, in fact, at this point. It may just be the householder sees him and is just furious. Right, maybe at the time, the householder, in fact, didn't confront him, or confronted him and lost. And now the householder runs across the thief again, and he kills him. Eina horgo neherag. So Rav Huna says that the householder, even though he's not killing him in defense of his money, and maybe he's killing him in a way which has no financial efficacy at all, he is not executed. So the Yerushalmi asks, "My Talmud Rav Huna, what's the reason, Rav Huna? Ki echam levavo." Right, the Rav believes that this is a case in which his heart is heated.
meaning that the Yerushalmi thinks that the case of the furtive trespasser ultimately comes down to and is justified by the same rationale as the case of the blood avenger, but that the blood avenger and the furtive trespasser for Rav Huna should be seen as examples of a broader principle. And furthermore, once we connect those two cases, the broader principle can only be the legitimacy of the crime of passion defense in halacha, which means that according to this Yerushalmi, the Netziv's reading of source number 12 is correct, and Bechor Shor's reading of the of source number 6 is correct. And here I want to introduce something that isn't in the source sheet. I mentioned earlier that Bechor Shor, in his commentary to Exodus Bet Yud Aleph, right, this is when Moshe kills the army, Vayar b'siv lotam, and Moshe saw the suffering, the oppression of the Jews, Shayu sovlim ol kasha, right, that they were suffering under a severe yoke, v'lodai b'ol, right, and it wasn't sufficient that they have this yoke, ela she'otu mitzri choveitu makeh oto hevri, but that this Egyptian was beating and striking that Jew, v'yecham levavo, and Moshe's heart was heated up, because his mercy was aroused towards his brothers. So if we assume, which I think is correct, that Bechor Shor is exempting Moshe Rabbeinu from punishment here on the same grounds that he exempts the householder, so we see here clearly that Bechor Shor takes the case of the blood avenger also as paradigmatic. So Bechor Shor and Etziv and the Yerushalmi all go together. At this point, we could end the shir, and we could say, you know what? We've come up with an utterly compelling case that halacha recognizes the crime of passion defense, even in criminal cases, meaning that halacha acknowledges that there are times when human beings simply cannot control themselves and cannot be held liable for their actions, that they don't have free will. Okay, but establishing the validity of a line of argument in halacha does not establish that that argument is correct, because halacha preserves multiple voices, and it might be that all the sources we have cited so far are, even if Netziv and Bechor Shor are correct in the readings of these Talmudic statements, maybe these Talmudic statements all represent minority opinions. And really, ultimately, halacha rejects this. The fact that one can construct such an argument does not mean that an argument is compelling. So let's take a look at some sources which seem to indicate that way. On Erevin Mem Aleph Mun Bet, Erevin 41b, we find the following statement in a Tanaitic text of Braita, Tanu Rabbanan, Gimel Dvarim Ma'avirin Et Hadam Al Da'ato V'Al Da'at Kono. That there are three things that compel a person to act against his own will and against the will of his creator. Ve'eluhein, these are of dekochavim, idolatry or idolaters actually, veruach ra'ah, and an evil spirit, which is usually translated nowadays as severe depression, v'dikduke aniyut, and the pangs of poverty, the stress of poverty. Okay, so first of all, we don't know how seriously to take this. Do we really believe that the poor are acting under compulsion? I don't think the Tosfot are quite that, in modern terms, liberal in saying that society is always guilty and not the innocent. But let's take this further. Tosfot thereupon say, why do we leave out the evil inclination? Because after all, we have the case in Ksuvot of Yetzirah Labsha. Right, which seems to indicate, right, that was source number 11, which seemed to indicate that desire can also cause people to act against their own will and that of their creator. So Tosfot says, Aflagav demashma v'perek elu megalchen, even though it implies in what we'll see as source number 18, shepamim sheitzro metgaber la v'nei ochol l'chufo, that there are times when one's inclination overwhelms one, and one is incapable of subduing it, Mikol makom adam yachol lizaher shlo yavol lidei kach. Nonetheless, a person can take care not to enter into such a situation. So Tosfos seems to believe that there are circumstances, right, that the fact that in the end one is, one may be overwhelmed under some situations, unless one was forced into the situation in which one is overwhelmed, one cannot make such a plea. So that would be a limitation on the previous categories, but maybe not so so important a limitation. It would, for example, still exempt the young man who was placed at the doorway to the brothel by his parents, and it might be that in a case where somebody else did the killing, or somebody else committed the act of adultery, that you could say you were compelled into such a circumstance. So it's a limitation, but it still largely leaves, I would say, Bechor Shor and the Netziv intact. Okay, but Tosfot makes mention, right, of that one particular, right, source, which seems to imply for Tosfot, right, I mentioned source number 11, but Tosfot actually mentions source number 18 as the evidence that one might be willing to concede that desire can overwhelm human beings to the point that they have no free will. So on that source, source number 15 says the following. De'avad k'Rabbi Eloy, right, that a particular scholar was buried in an intermediate grave. We don't know whether this is, the Talmud records a dispute. The intermediate grave as opposed to the best grave or as opposed to the worst quality grave. D'Tanya, as we learned in a bright, because he was placed there because he behaved like Rabbi Eloy. D'Tanya, because Rabbi Eloy said, Im ro'e adam shi'itzrom et gaber alav, a person sees their desire overwhelming them, yilech l'makom she'im makirin oto, he should go to a place where he's not recognized, yilbash shchorim, and wear black, v'yisatev shchorim, and hood himself in black, v'yaseh mashali bo chafet, and let him do what his heart desires, v'al yitchalel shem shemayim v'farhesya, and let the name of heaven not be publicly profaned. So that actually, at first glance, seems to utterly prove the case of Bechor Shor and Netziv. There are cases when you simply can't control yourself, you recognize that you no longer have free will, so you act as your heart desires. So Tosfos says you're required not to get into such situations, but again, if you're, you know, just placed in the door of the brothel all perfumed, so maybe in fact you're not legally responsible. So Tosfos' reading of this case, right, seems clearly to be that way. There are other people. Rabbi Nachmanal, for example, says that heaven forfend, Rabbi Eloy really meant that you're exempt in such a case and you could actually choose to go somewhere with intent to sin. It means all these are attempts to get you to repent, to delay the sin, to inspire the realization of the magnitude of your actions. But it seems that Tosfos reads this as saying that Rabbi Eloy really believes that there are circumstances in which your free will is taken away, and if you are not responsible for being in such circumstances, that Bechor Shor and Netziv are right. So at this point, we really seem to be in good shape. Except that here the Rush comes along, that's source number 18, and the Rush says, V'lesa lider Rabbi Eloy. The Rabbi Eloy is incorrect. Right? We rule against Rabbi Eloy. Why? Ela afal pishim iskaber yisroch l'adam alav, but rather, even if a person's desire overpowers him, so you're still required to quiet it. The Kaimelan, because we hold as a halachic principle, according to the Rush, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven, meaning that your decisions as to whether to do good and evil, the Rush says, are always in your own hands, and therefore Rabbi Eloy, we rule against Rabbi Eloy. And the implication would seem to be that we rule against Bechor Shor and the Netziv as well. And that all the work we went to in the beginning of this year, establishing the viability of the crime of passion defense, does not in any way mean that, in fact, we paskin that way. So I want to make a number of distinctions which I think will, in fact, leave Bechor Shor and the Netziv intact. The major distinction here is that Rabbi Eloy is not talking post facto. He's not talking about whether we hold you liable after the fact. He's talking about your decision to go ahead and perform the act. And I think that what we can say is as following. What I've framed this year so far as saying that the stakes are whether we believe in absolute free will or not. Whether, right, that in order to absolve someone of legal responsibility, we would have to claim that they no longer have free will. But that's not necessarily true. It could be that somebody has free will, but everyone always has a choice and the capacity to overcome their inclination, but there are cases where it would be so difficult that we don't hold you legally responsible for failing to fulfill that possibility. And the Rush would agree entirely that there are times when one's temptation and circumstances and emotions are so strong that one cannot be held legally liable for one's actions. But you don't have the right to make that determination for yourself. And for yourself, you always have to recognize the possibility of free will. And so in the end, we reject Rabbi Eloi because he's an extreme statement. He says that you can decide for yourself that you're not capable of resisting this, but that doesn't mean that post facto somebody else wouldn't say that you should have resisted, but we're not going to hold you liable for not resisting. And parenthetically, I want to say that I was really very disturbed when Ari Goldman in his initial book, The Search for God at Harvard, attempted to justify a promiscuous youth on the grounds of Rabbi Eloi's statement, both because they say, I think that the Rush and the Rif, by the way, paskins the same way, so I think la'alacha, it seems likely that we paskin against Rabbi Eloi, and I think the grounds of it very much are that you're not allowed to make this decision for yourself. You can't justify your own behavior. Somebody else can retroactively justify your behavior, but also because clearly the whole point of Rabbi Eloi is you're not supposed to talk about it, and so mentioning it in a bestseller seems to me to be very much against both the spirit and letter of Rabbi Eloi. But again, it seems to me that the outcome here is that on the basis of the Choshor Netziv, and I think the Yerushalmi that confirms the reading, that Halacha in fact does recognize that there are times when human beings are placed in situations in which the capacity to exercise free will would be heroic, such that we don't hold you legally responsible. Although the halacha, right, nobody is ever entitled for themselves to make the decision that they are no longer legally responsible and that they no longer have the obligation to fight their evil inclinations. So free will stands, but free will is modified by a recognition of the degree of difficulty in exercising it.